Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest today is Eric Kingfisher. And Eric's with the Jefferson Land Trust, and he's been a wonderful guest any number of times on Nature Now. Last month, Eric was my guest when we talked about the work being done by the Jefferson Land Trust in partnership with the North Olympic Land Trust in Essex-Clallam County, work to better understand how climate changes will actually impact the regions and habitats in our area. In part one of our conversation, which aired the third week of April, you can find that podcast on the KPTZ website, of course. We talked pretty generally in part one, and in part two today, hope to talk more specifically about resiliency and change we're likely to see or not see directly around us in Jefferson and Clallam counties. So welcome back, Eric.
Yeah, thanks. Happy to be here.
Before we get into our discussion with Eric, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Oh, just a little hint on this one. This is one of my absolute favorite birds. And right now, its calls and its sounds are just filling the woods around my North Beach neighborhood. We'll come back later on in the show and tell you what made that sound. So when we generally think about climate change, I know it's easy to think that we're kind of in this special area and not much affected by the kind of climate changes or the questions of resiliency that other parts of the country are either experiencing or about to experience. But I want to just sort of quickly bring everybody's minds to focus. We will see impacts here. We'll see impacts in reductions in our summer river and stream flows, and then increased flows in the winters. And that's clearly going to have an impact on our aquatic ecosystems and probably salmon breeding. Of course, we'll also see, along with those changes in flow regimes, we'll see increased stream temperatures, of course, and diminished snowpack, delayed onset of winter freezing temperatures, obviously some coastal inundation due to sea level rise. And on the human side of that, and I think we're already seeing it, a lot of what we're calling now climate refugees, as people are leaving other parts of the country and coming to the Pacific Northwest. So with that as a little background, I want to do one more bit of background and ask Eric to join me in this. As we talk a lot about resiliency, and it's a word that gets bandied about in a lot of different settings. So Eric, from the standpoint of a conservationist, what does the term resiliency mean to you in that context of protection and conservation of farms, forests, wildlife habitats, and of course, with respect to the human communities dependent upon those habitats? And then tell us why the Land Trust in particular believes it's important to determine what and where the potentially most resilient areas are.
Yeah, it's an important theme for us all, I think, as we go about our lives and recognizing the changes that are happening now and what we have in front of us. So in the Land Trust community, when we think of resilience, most of the time we're thinking about ecological resilience, but there's lots of different ways in which we can think about resilience. But when we're thinking about ecological resilience, we're thinking about the capacity of an ecosystem to respond to disturbance, in resisting damage and recovering quickly without shifting to an alternative state or losing its function or services, right? So to be resilient means it can bounce back. So, you know, all ecosystems face some kinds of hazards or, you know, some sorts of changes or pressures or stresses, drought and fire and flooding. And these are, a lot of these are hazards which are exacerbated by our changing climate, right? Mm-hmm. So more resilient systems are able to absorb larger shocks without changing in like fundamental ways.
Mm-hmm.
While less resilient systems are less capable of adapting to change and more vulnerable to those harmful impacts. And so by planning to preserve and enhance resilience within our landscape and our land base, land trusts like Jefferson Land Trust can work to increase the essentially the adaptive capacities of the lands that we both help protect and help take care of.
And so, I'd like to kind of ground our discussion with some specifics about the geography and the ecology and the habitats around us. As we think about just basic habitat and biodiversity, what are the basic features and where are the lands that are most likely to retain their ecological integrity and to be resilient? You know, I sort of look around here in this wonderful community and habitat we live in, and I don't know how to sort through it in my brain.
Yeah.
Which are the ones that will be the most resilient?
Yeah, I know. it's kind of a hard concept. And I think it's worth starting with just recognizing that conservation in general, what we've been doing is as a movement, you know, as an approach that people have taken to being in a place and trying to protect a place from the kinds of changes that they're seeing elsewhere. We want to help protect lots of places from being converted to other things that where they're supporting our current way of life and our current biota and land base. And they have the potential to do that in the future. So a lot of times we're thinking looking at a landscape and looking at a property, let's say we're trying to help protect, and we want to recognize, well, what's the historical condition here? What's the history of this place? And what's its, you know, ecological history and human history, depending on the conservation intentions we might have. And that's all still really important. But I think what's changed for the conservation movement in general, at least in my mind, is that we really have to be thinking about that property not as it was, you know, 500 years ago or whatever its mm-hmm. ecological function has been for thousands of years. We have to look at that and understand what it was, sure, and also be thinking about what it will be with, you know, hotter and drier summers and warmer and wetter winters constantly and increasing temperatures and less water availability potentially. And so there's going to be big changes on our mm-hmm. landscape everywhere in the world. And
change is a part of life, but this is it's a kind of a rate of change, magnitude of change issue.
Yeah. And so some places aren't going to be able to rebound or bounce back from the heat waves or whatever it is that's causing those changes. Or maybe it's sea level rise. It's going to change. It's going to convert whatever it is to something different. And so we have to look at these things and understand the best of our ability what those future scenarios are going to be. So our conservation goals need to kind of shift from those focused on preserving current patterns of species, mm-hmm. numbers, and compositions at particular places towards goals focused on maintaining processes and both the ecological and even evolutionary processes that are in play on our land base and our part of the world and our place that we care about.
So if you think about, and I'm just going to say East Jefferson County for the moment, and, you know, I think about the habitats here, and I think about the forests, the streams. Can you tell me, like, where do you think the most resilient habitats are going to be, or where are they? What did you learn from your study?
Yeah, and this is something that has been worked on. It's a big question. It's an important question. It's a question that's been worked on by some outstanding scientists and a lot of different partners and public agencies and other nonprofit conservation organizations. In particular, the Nature Conservancy has done some really important work on this. And we've generally determined that to protect biodiversity, we really got to focus on three main elements. So that's the complexity of landforms and the connectivity of natural systems and a variety of geology types So in other words, we must preserve lands that are diverse both above and below ground, and they're connected to other protected lands. And these complex and connected landscapes offer a wide range of microclimates, which can help facilitate plants and animals to adapt to change. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And it makes sense in the almost simplistic way that a monoculture forest land is less resilient than one that has a lot of diversity. So basically, that's what you're saying, isn't it? That you're looking for something that's got that kind of built-in variety, both biologically and sort of geologically.
Yeah, and topographically. Complexity of a landform is going to have lots more micro niche habitats within it. You know, there's going to be different aspects to those slopes and different pockets where water is retained. And all of that, that diversity will then create these little refugia for habitat or for species that otherwise might be distributed broadly right now, but in the future may not have as many places to thrive. And those places might be their remaining refugia in the future. So with lots of diversity in the landscape and the on landform, you're going to have more, essentially more biodiversity. And so that has become one of the things that we've tried to use in our spatial analysis, looking at our land base to then help prioritize really where are those places that have high resilience, have features that have a resilience index, so that we can say, okay, well, across our landscape, there's all these different land forms and there's different topoclimatic diversity here and here and here. And then we look at a lot of other features in addition to that, a lot of other data, and we boil it all down and look for different priority opportunity areas.
So, and you mentioned connectivity, and I'm thinking, you know, just a couple of years ago, the Land Trust was highlighting and stressing the work that had been done over the last 25 years or so on the Quimper Wildlife Corridor, and the notion of a wildlife corridor kind of corresponding to, you know, aquatic drainage and the connectivity of habitats. Is that an example of a system that has greater chances of being resilient and changing, but still being vibrant?
Yeah, we like to think, as scientists have been able to look at a lot of different parts of the world, including our part of the world, and say, well, where are wildlife most likely to be moving? In a really macro sense, and look at the landscape and look at the features of the land, and where is wildlife most likely to be moving based on that landform and that land base? And that's been really helpful. And then we also have scientists out there actually documenting where the wildlife is and where it's moving. And there's some enormous projects going on right now in the Olympic Peninsula with cameras, remote cameras that are sensing where the different wildlife is. And the data that's generated from that is going to help us increase the amount of understanding that all these managers and scientists have to continue to advance strategic conservation goals, make sure we're being as precise as we can and being as effective as we can with that. And the flow of wildlife and the data that has been developed is embedded in some of the resiliency work that we were doing. Some of the resiliency data that we were using in our analysis was all part of that. Mm. So the way connectivity is expressed on the landscape as part of the resiliency index.
So I want to shift a bit to thinking about working farms in forests, maybe to think about forests first. Are there certain types of forests or types of tree communities that are likely to retain their productivity over time? And I want to talk about not only productivity, but the term ecological services we've started to use over the last decade or so, that the forests are not only providing timber resources, they also provide these other things of value. In our neck of the woods, what kind of forest are those that are, they're going to retain their values?
That's an important question for sure. And, you know, as all of our listeners here know, I mean, we live in a forested land base, right? We're not some sort of, we're not in a desert environment. We're not in some sort of tundra environment. We're not in some sort of grassland environment. We're not in some sort of, you know, alpine environment. We're in a forested place. And that's a big feature of our landscape. So we've spent a lot of time looking at this with our most recent spatial analysis for conservation planning. and with a focus on resiliency and climate resiliency. And with forestry, it's an interesting question. And we talked the last time I was on about the way we divided our attention around resilience for the spatial analysis work we were doing. And we generally, if you look at our conservation plan, and listeners are welcome to go to our website, it's SAVELAND, saveland.org. And there you'll find all sorts of information, including some of our conservation planning work that we've done, including the resilience spatial analysis that we're talking about today. But one of the things we did back in 2008, 9, and 10 was developed a strategic conservation plan that really tried to look out about 100 years. And we worked with the community to generate a lot of information, and that people shared a lot of information with us. And we, in that process, developed what we now call the four pillars of our work. We just recognize that the community wants the land trust to be working on habitat biodiversity protection as one pillar. Another pillar is forestry, ensuring our forested land base stays a forested land base and it doesn't become, you know, suburban sprawl instead. That we have agricultural lands we want to protect as a third one. And then another one we call community conservation, just the well-being of our community and the kind of land base that we can help protect that supports the well-being of the people that live here. And so of those four pillars, we looked at all of those in this particular resilience study, and forestry was one of them. So when looking at forests, we tried to look at a lot of different things. And as you're pointing out, when we were looking at forest, like the forestry pillar of things, we want to ensure we can maintain the forest land base here. And a lot of that forest land base is commercial timberland. This is forest land that's being managed primarily for fiber production for 2x4s. And so those places have their own management regime based on, and that they're following the rules that are set by the state, what can and can't happen there. And those are, you know, essentially that's the clear cut landscape that you see out there. The clear cuts happen every 30 or 40 years, depending on the property. And when you think about the resilience of those places, well, what are those forest lands, or where are those forest lands that are going to be able to maintain their productive timber, you know, their ability to produce timber, to continue to be a good place to grow trees. And as you kind of alluded to earlier, you know, a lot of these places are primarily Douglas fir forest plantations, essentially. Mm-hmm. They're planted trees that are coming from a nursery, planted in the ground, they grow, and they grow really well, they grow fast, and they grow strong. And those become really valuable. And that becomes more of a monoculture environment. And the threats then become higher, or the risk becomes higher when we have things like foliar diseases or other insect outbreaks that might target that kind of species, right? And the stress that comes from those hot, dry summers and other climate conditions that are going to make it difficult for those trees to survive, then open those trees up that much more to disease. And so more diversity amongst the forest lands can help with the resilience of those places. And there's a lot of people working on this, a lot of different, you know, the timber industry, among others, are looking at, well, how do we do this so that we can maintain some resilience in these forests? The other thing, of course, is fire. And we've seen fire increasing across the West. Everybody knows that now. And that's another thing that has to be, these forest managers have to be mindful of. There's more potential for more catastrophic fires here with hotter and drier summers, and how to manage to reduce those risks. There's a lot of literature out there, but again, increasing the diversity of the trees and also the structural diversity of the trees and allowing more older trees to be in there.
You're talking about things like age, class, and
and more downed wood. More exactly. Some big trees, little trees, mid-sized trees. And that diversity of the structure then changes the nature of a fire that would go through. So then it would also increase its resilience when it comes to when that fire happens, because there will be fires. When those fires come through, then it will be able to bounce back better than if it were all otherwise single.
So that's an example, very clear one, of resiliency, that bouncing back. I want to ask you to just spend the next couple of minutes talking about working farmlands, the agricultural lands that are so important around here, and the small farmers.
Great, And well, there's something similar about agricultural lands, and at least in our analysis, and the forest lands, the working forest lands and working farmlands are similar in that they're both going to maintain their productivity if they are able to retain some water. That is just generally a feature that is correlated with productivity, right? So we actually spent some time diving in and studying water retention potential for our land base. And we came up with a water retention index that became a really helpful feature when analyzing our land base for resilience. And, you know, I can go into the nuances of all the different methodology that we used to get to this, but we finally rolled up all of our data and found ourselves looking at different priority opportunity areas that have some of the highest resilience scores based on these different methods that we used across our land base for these different pillars. And so for agricultural lands, our priority opportunities that came up that seemed to be the places that have high quality soils, mm-hmm. farmland of importance or soils of importance or prime soils. And they have a high potential to retain water. And it's, you know, particularly through those summer months when that's going to be pretty important. And really, as you can imagine, Center and Beaver Valleys yeah. are highlighted in that process. And a lot of that great farmland based on their soil types and the water retention index score really does show up as pretty exceptional farmland. And it has the potential to continue to be exceptional farmland long into the future if we can help protect it and keep it from being exploited or otherwise converted. There's also some pockets of that good resilient agricultural land down in the Quilson area, the Leland Creek and Little Quilson mm-hmm. River Valley area, and also around the Donovan Creek as well. And those all showed up as resilient agricultural lands.
Yeah, it makes me feel so good about what our community has done for local community farms and small farms, and sort of that vibrancy and community resiliency is like, yeah, some good things are happening here. Eric, let me just circle back around. You said if folks were interested in looking at like the various spatial analysis maps or looking at the results of your study, you could get to them through the Land Trust website, which is saveland.org. After they get on the website, what do they do?
Yeah, there's a search bar or search function. Just hit the search function and just type in resilience or land
or climate or
study, climate or something like it should show up. And then, or conservation planning or something like that.
Okay, now I have one more question, but what are the next steps? Where's the work going from here?
Yeah, that's great. Well, we are continuing to use it. I mean, so in our, we have it all in our GIS system. That's a geographic information system. It's a spatial database, basically. And we're able to pull that up. And when we are working on new projects, sometimes we, as a land trust, people come to us and say, hey, I'm interested in you helping me protect a piece of land. Other times we go to landowners and say, hey, this is a important property. Would you be interested in working with us? And so we use it in both ways, you know, and we also are looking at it with regards to stewardship. And we recognize that some of the properties we've helped protect are already in these priority resilience areas. And other places are not within those priority resilience, don't have as much as maybe a highest score in resilience. And that means for us, a stewardship program forces us to ask the question, what can we do to manage this place to help it achieve higher resilience features or abilities and make it get it ready for what's coming? And so we've been doing more and more of that in the properties we own. We also work with a lot of private landowners with conservation easements and trying to work with them to encourage or identify ways in which things can be improved to increase their resilience or at least reduce vulnerabilities to climate stressors. So all that's happening based on the spatial analysis and otherwise generally around our conservation planning that recognizes that climate changes and the climate breakdown is a major driving force for what is going to be out there on these lands we've helped protect in perpetuity.
You know, it's so easy to get depressed and anxious about climate change and its impacts, but I have found our conversation actually very hopeful. So thank you.
Yeah.
Well, again, as usual, Eric, we could talk for a long time because I find this stuff endlessly interesting. But we need to listen to that mystery sound again. So, Nora, can you play that for us? Well, that, of course, was a spotted towhee. Sort of its buzzy, trilly kind of song. It's a little robin-sized bird. You see it a lot on the ground, sort of scratching for insects and other cool invertebrates, or sometimes on low branches or shrubs where the males are just singing their hearts out. So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. I hope you've enjoyed our program. And of course, I always will say, go listen to the podcast because you can hear everything there. Thanks for listening. And our ending music is You Are My Sunshine. It's a 1940 recording by Jimmy Davis.
The other night, dear, as I lay sleeping, I dreamed I held you in my arms. But when I woke, dear, I was mistaken, and I hung my head and cried. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away. I'll always love you and make you happy if you will only say the same. But if you leave me to love another, you'll regret it all someday. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
Dungeness River Nature Center is proud to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature. Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.